Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the writer Ross Gay. Ross Gay is assistant professor of English at Indiana University and author of the poetry collection Against Which. His new book, entitled Bringing the Shovel Down, was published by the University of Pittsburgh Press in 2011. His poems have appeared in American Poetry Review, Gulf Coast, Margie, Plowshares, and Sou'wester, among other publications. Gay also teaches in the low residency MFA program at Drew University and is a Cave Canem Fellow. Hi, Ross. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Good to have you in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
So you're going to start with some poems from your new book, Bringing the Shovel Down.
I am, yep. Okay. So this poem is called Love, You Got Me Good. Honey bunny, for you, I've got a mouthful of soot. Sweet pea, for you, I always smell like blood. Everything that touches me, love muffin, turns to salt. When I think of you, I see fire. When I dream of you, I hear footsteps on bones. When I see you, I can feel the scythe's smooth handle in my palm. Love, you got me standing at attention, clutching my heart, polishing guns. Love, I got a piggy bank painted like a flag. I got a flag in the shape of a piggy bank. For you, Sugarfoot, I've been dancing the waterboard. You're under my skin, love. Don't know what I'd do without you, love. And this next poem is called For Some Slight I Can't Recall. A lot of the poems in this book are, they mean to be sort of interrogations of kind of national violence, but also personal violence. And that's what this poem is trying to get at. For some slight I can't quite recall. Was with the pudgy hands of a 13-year-old that I took the marble of his head just barely balanced on his reedy neck. And with the brute tutelage of years fighting the neighbor kids, and to the lightning of my father's stiff palm, I leaned the boy's head full force into the rattly pane of glass on the school bus, and did so with the eagle of justice screaming in my ear, as he always does for the irate and stupid. I made the window sing and bend, and the skinny boy too, whose eyes grew to lakes lit by mortar fire, bleating with his glasses crooked. I'm not an animal. Walking in place on the green vinyl seat, looking far away. And me watching him and probably almost smiling at the song and dance I made of the weak and skinny boy who, towering above me, became even smaller and bizarre and bird-like, pinned and beating his wings frantically against his cage. And me probably almost smiling, as is the way of the stupid and cruel, watching the weak and small and innocent not getting away. And this poem is called American Dreaming. Bootstraps like barnacles on boats, bootstraps in blankets, bootstraps in Bibles, bootstraps on bonnets bubbling up from the brook's bottom. Bootstraps make a slave's back bloom. Bootstraps in back rooms. Bootstraps cinched to shackles in the womb. Plumes of bootstraps billow and consume. Bootstrap nooses, bootstrap bullets, bootstrap bombs dropped on buildings from which blazing bodies blossom. Bootstraps dangling from coffins, shaped like bassinets in which ankles fester and weep. And this poem here is called Axe Blade. There she is again, studying her face in the mirror of an axe blade, which reflects as well the hand-shaped welt wrapping her jaw. While the baby on her lap feeds, she dreams about that man asleep on the couch, how the steel wedge plunged into that skull might well loose the lover it once housed, the one who could run the back of his hand along her neck such that every bone in her body would exhale, who would sit on the tub's edge singing to her as he eased the sponge along her tired back. The axe has her dreaming how bloodshed begets beauty. And when she hears the throaty rattle from the other room, she sits the infant in his crib, grips the axe, and goes to find her man.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Ross Gay. He's reading from his new book, Bringing the Shovel Down, published by University of Pittsburgh Press. Ross, I wanted to ask you about this idea of writing towards an idea of book. We had talked a little earlier, and you said that you wrote poems for Bringing the Shovel Down with an idea of a book in mind, and I'm not sure how one does that. I mean, because often don't you find poems that just come to you, and so how do you negotiate that?
Yeah, you know, with the first book that I wrote, Against Which, you know, I think I had the experience that a lot of folks do with their first book, which is that the first whatever, or the best 50 poems I had or whatever, were the book. But with this project, I now knew what it meant to sort of write all of the poems that make up a book. And so I wanted to, instead of just be thinking about how to write a poem that will become a book, I was thinking about how you write a book. And someone was actually saying to me recently, like asking me if they thought a lot of people's second books are kind of like project books. And it makes a certain kind of sense. I don't know if it's true or not, but for me, I definitely had the idea of a book as being the thing that I wanted to tackle now rather than just the poems that make up the book. It's sort of an interesting contradiction, though, because I'm moved by poems. I'm not moved by book projects. I'm moved by individual poems. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there was a kind of struggle or tension in the idea of like writing toward this bigger thing that had a kind of coherence, while also knowing that in my own experience of poems, reading them, that I am moved by individual poems.
Mm-hmm. So when you're writing this book, and did you had a framework of an idea that drove the engine of the writing?
Yeah. It was basically, I was sort of the book in the most sort of basic way means to be a kind of interrogation of the mythologies about power, about nation that we believe in. And it means to interrogate those things, and it means to complicate those things, and it means ultimately to sort of imagine what might how we might transcend those things, imagine something else. You know, I have an epigraph of the book in the book to the book by Audre Lorde, the wonderful Audre Lorde, and the epigraph just reads, "Our children cannot dream unless they live. They cannot live unless they are nourished. And who else will feed them the real food without which their dreams will be no different from ours?" I'll just say it again because I think it's so good to say. Our children cannot dream unless they live. They cannot live unless they are nourished. And who else will feed them the real food without which their dreams will be no different from ours? So I think I'm trying to imagine what might we do so that their dreams can be different from ours.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And the we you're talking about, the nation you're talking about is U.S. or is it a different we?
I mean, I think it's me. You know, it's me.
The
nation of Ross first. But then, you know, yeah, I think I'm imagining like any individual, certainly who would pick up this book, but I think I'm asking the question to like of all of us. I understand that, you know, a limited number of people are going to read this book of poems. But I think, yeah, maybe it's like I'm asking the question of the universe in a way.
Okay.
Maybe that's what a book of poems is.
Okay. Okay. Can you read more poems?
Yeah. So this next poem is called The Lion and the Gazelle. Because the bullet was a dream before it was a bird. Because the bullet was a dream before It alighted in the child's body while he looked at a pigeon wobbling through the air. Because the child has moved into photographs on mantles and the dreamer's hands are folded in his lap and have not felt a dead child's face as the blood empties from it. Because this is not a dream. Because it is not a dream that a lioness is laying on its side while a gazelle pumps her teat with its spindly neck and dust lifts around them as the lioness licks the fawn's bony skull. That the lioness was alone and her two cubs had starved to death. That she was wandering across the scorched plain and found the fawn bleating and a quiver beneath some shrub. That, salivating, the mother nosed the fawn to its feet and its genetic proclivities toward flight and quick disappeared despite the wet teeth above it. That it was their haphazard search for some hoped-for oasis, their night sky, the lion and the fawn. If you've never fingered the feathery neck of some small animal, if you've never curled beside your weaker sibling making his lips bleed, if you've not been pinned to the damp earth while someone decided what this cigarette, what this blade, what this shivering hand, and if your father never entered a drunken rage and emptied his gun into the family dog watching the small bones of your face go slack, if you've not awoken from a dream wet-faced and weeping and wondering what gasp, what wretch and rack you might do and might be done unto you, wondering, what have we done? Never contemplated the bullet's song entering the body, or the boy turned moan, turned thousand dust motes gathering on a photo on a mantle, the mother looking away as the fawn tugs at the dry nub, as the suckling grows weaker, and the small thing lay quiet in the dust not twitching for flies, and her mother curled around her, watching the night move across the plains, and the sound of the flies doing their patient work, and the lion's heavy, ashen panting against the night. And this poem is called Learning to Speak. And this is a poem that, it's a poem for my father, in a way, who, you know, watched, grew up in a house where there was a good bit of violence, and was a man who, you know, a person who did not replicate that. So he's sort of sort of miraculous, I think. That's a gift. It's called Learning to Speak. I've never told you about my old man's last day watching his mom's jaw get rattled, when something almost snapped the way he leaned the steak knife into the man's throat and held his hand like a baby, the way you hold a baby and whisper it to sleep with songs it will never stop hearing. My father, the boy, watching his mother, cracked every which way, and the boy almost snaps. By every calculation and probability, the boy grows up to be a man whose thousand broken hearts and tongue of lead can only say, I hurt or I am scared, with his knuckles in some smaller thing's mouth. By every calculation, my mother, my brother, me. You know, we are at every turn, laundromat, subway, courtroom, ball game, shoulder to shoulder, face to face with someone who didn't shoot the dog or burn the kid, who didn't fist his rage across someone's face. At every turn, we're in the midst of these small lanterns lighting a road away from the grooved and dank one. Whether we know it or not, each one of them, day after day after day after day, teaching and reteaching the stones of their hands this new language, which their hands in turn teach to us.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Ross Gay, reading from his new book, Bringing the Shovel Down. I was thinking while you were reading that, you know, there's a great sense of sound in your work and a sense of song almost, and especially with the bootstrap poem, which you're almost singing in a way. Mm-hmm. And yet some of the songs are very disturbing. So these disturbing songs, and I was wondering if you saw yourself as like creating new disturbances in your book through the context of how you're delivering things, you know, creating these beautiful songs with all this violence. And you've said that you that you're interrogating how we look at nation and how we deal with the stories that form us. But I wonder, do you think you're creating new disturbances in order to do that?
Yeah. That's such a good question. I mean, you know, my intention definitely is to complicate and to sort of, you know, by sort of making melodic, say, the awful, to complicate that and to, you know, suggest, well, maybe these are things that are sort of presented as songs that we need to sort of think about. But there's this other sort of really like great fundamental question that I think you're asking too, which is like, what does it mean to aestheticize the terrible? What's it mean to make a poem out of what's awful? So, and the way you put it is, you know, are you creating more disturbances? I think Lucille Clifton said, you know, the job of the poet is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And I hope that the poems, do that. I hope that they don't simply sort of add to the disturbances, you know?
No, I wasn't saying.
I didn't think you were.
Are you creating a disturbance?
I didn't think you were.
I didn't think you are.
But I do think of that. I do think of that. When you write a poem that's sort of a terrible poem that means to do that, I think it's a really good question. Are we, in fact, sort of raising the level of the disturbance, you know?
Yeah, and some readers will be disturbed. And yet I think what you're saying is they need to be in order to get to the next level of thought or transformation, which you've talked about.
Yeah.
So I know you've used language like transformation, universe, outer space. You use outer space. I just wanted to ask you about that. When you were talking about your poems earlier, you said, and then I go into outer space. I want to ask you about the relationship between writing and, you know, different kinds of travel. I mean, do you believe that you really do travel? I don't want to get too cosmic here, but that you have to sort of let the bottom drop off out of this kind of this reality in order to find the courage to make those disturbances or something like that. I don't know. Just tell us why you're talking about outer space.
Yeah. Well, I think probably when we're making metaphor that we are, in fact, I mean, the intention is to, in fact, invent an experience and invent a way of seeing the world. So that, you know, it's like when you invent a word for something, you're in fact inventing the experience for other people who do not, right? I think that's pretty much the case. So in making metaphor, which to me is like kind of, I think, the main thing of making poems, it's in fact like sort of, it's inventing language, it's inventing thought, it's inventing experience in some way, or at least articulating those things. So I think when I'm saying like going to outer space, like I think it's going far away, you know, it's going outside of the sort of bounds or the conventions of our day-to-day life. It feels, you know, sort of spacey is not the right word, but it's like traveling. Traveling's the right word, yeah.
Okay. Could you read some more?
Yeah, totally. I'm going to read this poem called Say It. And Say It is a poem that I wrote for a few of my friends who died young. a lovely poet named Phoebus Etienne and a friend named Becky Claus. And but it feels like it becomes a kind of poem also for my old man, and I'm going to read it for Judith Vollmer. Say it. If I told you we were slapping the beat to some Barry White jam crooning from the boom box, and that every single one of us at one point or another jumped up to shake what shook on us, and there were lines of us in step and a loon in every one of our mouths, who knew? And one of us in his pressed shirt dancing his dead father's hunched back smooth, and another singing back up like hers, and another shaking his head no, but meaning yes, oh yes. And if I told you the proprietor of this roti joint dragged his wife from the kitchen where she was busy currying chana for the best doubles in Brooklyn so she too might witness this unabashed racket, this stampede of glee and goof, this clan of black clad. And if I told you today we laid down one too young to lay down. Praise the body, its miraculous stutter and thrum. Praise its slosh and drag and drone and every particulate diving toward the dirt. The rampant heart, its last kick and holler, the blood clot's last long swim to the lung. Praise the lung, its last whistle, and the kidneys no more. Say this. Say praise the machine hiss your father became and the quick way he gave it up. Say praise the liver's dread swell. Say it again. Say it with your heart and neck and lent throat gaped and flayed to the sky. Say it covering someone's hand with yours, straightening your tie. Say it to the earth's fat mouth. Say it the way you can turn on your heel to spark fire and make your limber hip twist like a lesser storm, or the way there is a storm between your two good hips, which are good, good music if you listen. Say it in your polished shoes to the organist, say it too. Praise the heart, its rivers, and each rope twisted in the body, and every bird housed in the body. Vulture, gull, raven, jackrabbit, cask, wick, and flame a bird too. Say praise to flame, a bird too. Praise to the nerve endings in your teeth, and to your tongue like a blind man's hand reading her teeth, and the tongue inside the eyes, and the nose in the tongue, and the heart in the tongue. Say praise to salt, tear, stain, and skin ripped apart like a kite flipping in the wind. Praise the rip in the kite and the geese flying through it. Praise the wings you swore you had when you were 6 years old and the wings that remain today. Praise every flower you never smelled and every dog you never kissed and the skinny farmer at the market with bad teeth who gave you his last cantaloupe and peppers and snap peas who you never kissed. Praise the handful of freckles dashed across your father's face that you never kissed until he would not wake again. Say it. Say it again. Say praise the sunlight trapped on your father's face and the body's slapdash racket slipping away. If you want to or not, clean the dirt from your teeth and the glass from your fists. If you want to or not, tie both your shoes and fix your suspenders and praise the heart inside the heart, cracking its shackles, its thunderclap shrug, its 2,000 dolphins waving goodbye. Praise every day the 2,000 dolphins waving goodbye, shaking off our hearts and waving goodbye.
Nice poem.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks. This poem is called Overheard. Overheard. It's a beautiful day, the small man said from behind me, and I could tell he had a slight limp from the rasp of his boot against the sidewalk, and I was slow to look at him because I've learned to close my ears against the voices of passers-by, which is easier than closing them to my own mind. And although he said it, I did not hear it until he said it a second or third time. But he did. He said, "It's a beautiful day." And something in the way he pointed to the sun unfolding between two oaks overhanging a basketball court on 10th Street made me, too, catch hold of that light, opening my hands to the dream of the soon blooming. And never did he say, "Forget the crick in your neck, nor your bloody dreams." He did not say, "Forget the multiple shades of your mother's heartbreak, nor the father in your city kneeling over his bloody child, nor the five species of bird this second become memory. No, he said only, it's a beautiful day. This tiny man limping past me with upturned palms, shaking his head in disbelief.
I think we have time for one more.
Great. Good, good. This is called Sorrow Is Not My Name, and it's actually after a Gwendolyn Brooks poem. No matter the pull toward brink, no matter the florid deep sleep awaits, there is a time for everything. Look, just this morning, a vulture nodded his red, grizzled head at me, and I looked at him, admiring the sickle of his beak. Then the wind kicked up, and after arranging that good suit of feathers, he up and took off. Just like that. And to boot, there are on this planet alone something like 2 million naturally occurring sweet things, some with names so gorgeous as to kick the steel from my knees. Agave, persimmon, stickball, the purple okra I bought for $2 at the market. Think of that. The long night, the skeleton in the mirror, the man behind me on the bus taking notes. Yeah, yeah. But look, my niece is running through a field calling my name. My neighbor sings like an angel, and at the end of my block is a basketball court. I remember, my color's green. I'm spring. And I'll finish with this short poem. It's called Ode to the Redbud, which is a tree. Ode to the Redbud. You trillion hallelujahs, you jump up, silly, and scream. You luscious, you luminous, you firebrand blazing, you sugar knot and swagger, you bird hive, you TNT, you bloodstreams, thousand tongues, you hemoglobin tumble and throttle, you teeth dragged across a scapula, you pelvic, you pushing down and howling up, you florid muscle of the mouth and pink house, you slick dream and holler machine, you lap for washing my face clean.
That was a nice one, too.
Thanks.
A lot of great ones there. You've been listening to the poetry of Ross Gay, and he's reading from his new book, Bringing the Shovel Down, University of Pittsburgh Press. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's been great. Fun. Cool.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment Newsweekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody, 90.5 FM.